You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, and welcome to Book Lovers Cafe. Book Lovers Cafe is a program of author interviews and book reviews from around the sound and beyond, and I'm your host, Chris Wilson. Today, we will be talking to Joanne Tompkins about her first novel, the title, What Comes After, and you will be wondering, what does come after? It's been published recently to great reviews by Penguin Random House in New York. Let me just read to you a little blurb from the back of the book from our very own Erica Bauermeister. A book for the ages. A powerful, compassionate page-turner, What Comes After dives deep into the best and worst of humanity and comes out singing. This is a story of families failed and made, of lives lost and found and taken, and of anger and forgiveness. Joanne Tompkins is a clear-eyed reader of souls, and she gives them to us in all their complicated and terrible beauty. There you go. There's also been great reviews in the New York Times. So both from a column that makes recommendations for book groups. New York Times called it a wallop of a debut novel. And also difficult but elegant, shows the resilience of community during the hardest things. Well, there you go. If you don't want to read it now, I don't know what else to say. Welcome to you, Joanne. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks, Chris. I'm just really excited to be here. I love KPTZ.
Oh, nice of you to say. Well, congratulations on this book. And I'd like to begin really with you, because it is a debut novel. Can you tell us a little bit about what was your path and inspiration for this book, for writing this story?
Well, those are kind of two questions. I've been writing for a very long time. I started writing probably 20 years ago, and I just worked at it here and there, but at times very diligently, and other times, you know, kind of set it aside for a couple of years. But at a certain point, in 2015, I decided that I really wanted to buckle down, and I started an MFA program. Mm. And it was there that I wrote this book as my master's thesis. And the inspiration in general was that I had a prior career as a lawyer and mediator, where I worked with a really traumatized population. And I was just so struck by how people recovered from trauma and moved on with their lives. And I always knew it was not a straight path, that people struggled, right? I mean, that they would get to these wonderful places, but not easily. And so I wanted to write a book that examined, what do you do when the worst things that you can imagine happen to you? How do you survive and how do you move forward?
That's one of the things that I admired about the book, is that there wasn't an easy solution. You know, your characters would take a step forward and then they go backwards. And that's really authentically what happens in life. So I think that's one of the wonderful things about this book. So the book begins with the raw facts. It actually says those words on the first page. So why don't you help us understand what the raw facts are? What does the reader know from the very beginning?
Well, the book opens with this terrible and shocking murder of a teen in a small town that people from here will quickly recognize as Port Townsend, even though it's called Port Furlong. It's not identical to Port Townsend, but it's very, very similar. And the murder is discovered when another teen, a boy that is considered to be like one of his closest friends since childhood, commits suicide and leaves a note to where Daniel's body can be found. So this is what the father of the murder victim is dealing with at the opening of the book, that this terrible, shocking thing has happened, that a boy he considered to be a second son has murdered his only child and then taken his own life. And the book moves forward from there.
Mm-hmm. So some of your reviewers have called this a mystery, but it is not a traditional mystery. This is the kind of mystery that is psychological, and it's like peeling back the pieces of an onion to reveal, you know, what is in the hearts of your main characters. So let's talk about those three characters. I think maybe the best thing to do is to introduce them with some readings from the book. So would you be willing to read us a little bit about Isaac and introduce him to our listeners?
Yeah, I would love to do that. Where we'll start, we just heard sort of a summary of the opening from Isaac where he's revealing what he knows, which is in some ways everything, and in really more important ways, nothing. He knows what has happened in its barest outline, but he doesn't know anything else. So at chapter 3 is the next time we hear from Isaac. And here it is. News of my son's death traveled even faster than that of his disappearance. It was a loss felt by our entire community and made all the more painful by its violent cause, by Jonah's suicide, by Seattle news teams that swooped in to sensationalize. Many in town speculated about girls and jealousies, drug deals, and psychotic breaks, but not one fact surfaced that lent the slightest credibility to any of it. The need for public outlets of grief was intense. Within the week, a student memorial was held in the school's overflowing gym. This was followed a few days later by a Catholic mass filled to capacity, mourners packed even in the vestibule. Catherine had insisted upon the mass. Though Daniel never considered himself Catholic, I didn't object. Catherine, who had divorced me the year before, grieved as deeply as I did, likely more so for having chosen to live elsewhere, for failing to be present the last 10 months of her son's life. I understood this and wished her whatever comfort she could find. Still, for my part, these events left me cold. And I am not a cold man. At least, at one time, I was not. So there's Isaac trying to figure out, essentially, can he become what he used to be, which is not a cold man.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so sometimes when bad things happen, some people just withdraw so completely.
Mm-hmm.
So Isaac, he's about 50 years old, correct?
Yes.
And so he's the father. And another important thing about him is that he is a Quaker, a practicing Quaker. And actually, you might consider him one of the leaders of the Quaker community in Port Furlong, which is a unprogrammed Quaker meeting. And for those of you who don't know about this, can you tell us what an unprogrammed Quaker meeting is like?
Well, an unprogrammed Quaker meeting is one that is based, at least starts in community silence, and may be the entire hour in community silence unless anyone in the community that is present feels moved to break the silence with a message to the group that feels like it has been inspired by a connection to the one or the divine. And not all Quakers are that way. Some have pastors and services. But this particular character in my book, Isaac, is an unprogrammed Quaker. And that is the Quaker meeting house that we have here in
mm-hmm.
Port Townsend.
Mm-hmm. And so silence is an important part of this, and that's an important part of Isaac's story, too. Let's move on to another pivotal character, and this is Evangeline. And can you read to us a little bit about her and describe her to the listeners?
Okay, so yes, Evangeline is 16, and she, what we know about her at the point that I'm reading is that she has been abandoned for the last 3 months in a trailer in the woods at the edge of town, and her mother left, probably due to a drug addiction, and she's been scrambling by, but she knows that she's going to be evicted very soon. There's been notices on the door, and she needs to find a new place to be. She also knows she's pregnant, and so she is trying to figure out how she is going to survive for herself and for her baby. And the scene I'm about to read, it's an October night. She has ventured out into the roads and is looking down on the town and trying to make a plan for herself and the baby. So here we are. As she rounded a corner, the lights of town crept into view, strung along the shore below. When she'd arrived with her mother in the spring, Evangeline had thought the place was nothing more than a half dozen blocks of old buildings. But even from this modest elevation, you could see that it was much larger. Port Furlong fanned for a few miles from a corner that jutted into the sound, sprawled across multiple low-slung hills, surrounded a small lake. The Victorian settlers had savaged the dense firs, stripped the earth for their buildings and homes and family farms. Grand trees stood in parks and along rural roads, but in town, people had taken their place. 10,000 people, more in the summer, her mother had said. Now the whole of the town glittered, and Evangeline thought how this haunted old place woke each night, ghosts wandering the turrets and gables and widow's walks of the Victorian homes. Even downtown, with its massive brick courthouse and post office, with its finials and balustrades and rows of high-arched windows, seemed to bustle with the shadows of century-old business deals, with stiffly dressed couples floating through brick walls, seeking marriage licenses or letters from across the sea. And beyond all this was the sound, where she could feel as if tossing inside herself, the sailboats and tugs and ferries that pitched in the water's black churn. Homes glowed on the hill above the town. She imagined the dinners and homework and family conversations taking place in those lighted rooms and wondered if she could ever belong somewhere like that, in a house you could walk into day after day, knowing you were home, knowing you were wanted. No, she thought, she never would. Yet she touched her belly and whispered, "But you will, baby, you will." Evangeline spotted a dark stretch in the middle of those glinting lights. She had glimpsed the place only twice, but remembered that it was on a couple acres surrounded by trees. The man, Isaac Balch, lived there alone. At least she thought he did. The papers said Daniel had no siblings and that his mother now lived in Spokane. The place was huge, too huge for a single old man. It would have to have lots of empty rooms and at least one extra bed. Not some broken-down sofa bed either. A real one, with sheets and comforter, a fluffy pillow or two. So that's Evangeline trying to picture a new life for herself and starting to formulate a plan.
Mm-hmm. And when she's introduced, you know, the reader now not only has a murder to deal with, but a girl who's homeless and pregnant. And so, again, we're just kind of hit with, wow, Now what? So the town, and you talk about it in this reading, it's more than the description of the lights and coming down Sims Way. It's, you really talk about the nature that's here, all of the different animals, the Victorian house that Isaac lives in. That's almost a character unto itself. Have you lived in an old house like that?
Yes. I mean, there aren't very many autobiographical elements of this book, but the house actually is one. It's based on the house I lived in at the time I was writing this book. When I owned it, in this particular book, the upstairs of that house is unfinished because it was built during the time of 1890 when the whole economy was collapsing. When I had bought that house, it had been finished, but it had been finished 100 years later. So I imagined that Isaac lived in this house with this unfinished upstairs. So, yes, the house was very much like the character in this book. It was a very alive house with a lot of personality. And in my particular case, a ghost, but I don't have a ghost in my book.
Are you sure? I know that's what I felt like as a reader. I'm going, now where's she going? Now where she's going?
So there might be a ghost, but yeah. I don't know.
Okay, so she is Joanne Tompkins, and you're listening to Book Lovers Cafe, and I'm your host, Chris Wilson. We're talking to Joanne about her book, What Comes After, and it's set in Port Townsend, and it has some incredible characters and a really good story. So let's go on to the last character that we want to talk about here, and that is Jonah. And you can't help but think about these names of Jonah being the troubled person that, you know, the burdens of life just keep falling on. So can you read us a little bit from the book about Jonah?
Sure. Jonah shows up in chapter 7, and so I'm going to read from there. The thing that it's important to understand is that when he speaks of Red is Evangeline. He never knew Evangeline's real name because she met both Daniel and Jonah in a park in the evening and was a little bit nervous about them and didn't give them her real name. So chapter 7, Day of My Death. It's 12:15 in the morning. I'll be dead in a few hours, 4 at the most. I'm not looking for pity. It's just how things are. I'm wearing lug-sole boots and canvas work pants, laying on top of my bed, a hard-sprung twin pressed against a wall. Something rattles and bangs outside. It's nothing, just a wind knocking over a rake. My mom and little sister are asleep in their rooms. I suppose Mom could be awake with a racket, but I doubt it. Not after her long day. And I'd know if Nels was. If you took out a wall, our beds would be touching. They'll figure out later that I said goodbye to them a few hours back. It's been 10 days since I met Red. The first time she looked at me, all I could think was, now that girl's eyes could slice a guy wide open. There was this crazy relief in being seen like that, in believing that Red knew me. Later, when her lips touched my cheek, in front of Daniel, no less. It burned so much that spot had to be glowing like some holy tattoo. You couldn't touch that girl without feeling your skin had disappeared, that you turned to water and flowed into a warm ocean. I'd give anything to touch Red one last time, to place a fingertip at the pulse of her throat, feel her life there, right there, hot and beating and contained. She's alive, that girl. So much she believes is possible. That's why I'm using these last few hours to figure things out. For her. She needs to know she's not to blame. I've only got my thoughts now, and I'm hoping that somehow they'll make their way to her. Not that I could begin to tell you in what world that would really happen, but it's pretty hard not to believe in unknown realms when that's exactly where you're heading. So that's Jonah as he's facing the last couple hours of his life.
Mm-hmm. I think in this reading you can feel, you know, the love that he has, but also the feeling, you know, that he feels cut off, that he's abandoned and he's isolated. And I think, you know, these are important themes in your story that hit multiple characters. Is that something that you often thought about in your role as a mediator, you know, just how people are not all one thing, you know, that evil acts may be committed? Can you talk a little bit about that, the nature of evil and how it's all mixed up with love?
Yeah. Oh, so that's such an interesting question and such a complicated and huge and profound question, but I'll do my best.
Okay.
One of the things actually that my editor asked me when I was working through this is she said, what, Joanne, are you trying to say about evil, right? And I thought, oh, what a good question. What am I trying to say about evil? And as a mediator, I worked with many, many people that did evil, evil things, right? Mm-hmm. I worked with many, many sexual predators, and I was trying to settle cases that involved their victims. And I had to be able to see them as more than the worst of their acts. So that was a practice I had as a mediator to understand that in some ways, evil at some level acts on all of us, and we don't necessarily translate it out into the world, and hopefully we rarely, if ever, do. But some people basically mm-hmm. are overcome with it, and they do. And the question is, are they more than that? Are they more than their worst act? And of course, everyone is. And when you look at someone like Jonah, who is 17 and has had a difficult life in many ways, but also one in which he has shown a great deal of love toward people, yet he has committed this heinous, heinous act. And so that is the question. Who is he, and how does evil fit in his mm-hmm. life, and how is he viewed afterwards, and mm-hmm. how does he view himself afterwards? How does he process right. something that awful that he did?
Yeah, and the decisions he makes. I think the chapters in The Voice of Jonah, where he's trying to wrestle with this himself about what he's going to do. He says the world needs vice in order to be good. Just not that that's true, but I love the fact that he's struggling philosophically with, you know, who he is and what he's going to do. But he ultimately, you know, he doesn't make the decision to murder Daniel. He, you know, ahead of time. So, you know, that's one reprieve for the character of Jonah. He doesn't plot this out, so to speak. But it builds the way, you know, people just sort of flash out, and especially teenagers, especially teenage boys. My goodness. So that's something that is wrestled with and dealt with and gives the reader something to think about among so many other things. You know, we haven't even scratched the surface. It's pretty amazing in this kind of a book that, you know, the reviews are calling a mystery thriller, really how many human issues are being talked about. So one of the things, another theme is forgiveness. And once again, we turn to Quakerism, not necessarily Quakerism, but there's a lot in here. So my question is, like, one thing is there's a clearness committee, and, you know, that just doesn't pop out of nowhere. Have you been a Quaker in your life? How did you come to learn so much about the practices of the Quakers?
Well, I am not a Quaker, but I did go spent nearly a month at Pendle Hill, which is a Quaker residential and learning community in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And while there, I spent several weeks participating on a regular basis in clearness committees, both as a focus person, so being in the role that my protagonist Isaac is in with regard to the committee, and then also being a committee member where someone else was struggling with an issue, and I was there as part of the committee to hold that person in the light and help that person who had the problem come to understand their own wisdom and their own path forward. And it was just such a powerful and surprisingly difficult thing to do, particularly as a committee member, because I found myself, I thought I would be great at it because I thought I was a mediator. I could totally do this, right? I mean, and when I realized when I was in it, you know, that all of a sudden I go, oh no, as a mediator, I always had my own agenda. I was trying to get the case settled. I was always thinking, what can I do next to get these people to closer to settlement? In a clearness committee, no matter how clear it is to you that you know exactly what that other person should be doing to get their life in order, your job is not to say that, right? Your mm-hmm. job is to quiet all the advice in your head and simply hold them, like hold their energy in love and in light, and trust them to understand their own path and that they have their own connection to divine wisdom and that they need to find it on their own terms. And I was shocked at how hard that was for me to do.
Mm-hmm. It is very difficult, especially a mother wants to give advice, right?
Yeah.
So I also, before we leave the topic of being a Quaker, Jonah attends meeting as well. So it's not just Isaac. And there's talk about a covered meeting. And can you explain what exactly a covered meeting would be? It's so much more than those two words.
Well, with the caveat again that I'm not a Quaker, but mm-hmm. this is how I came to understand it, and I experienced it. There is a feeling that, I mean, as I mentioned at the beginning, an unprogrammed meeting, if a friend, as Quakers call themselves, is called, has a inspiration to speak or provide a message to the group, they do that. But there are times in a group when you can feel like the divine has risen up in the entire group. There's something just incredibly powerful about it, where you just feel almost moved to tears. And mm-hmm. I experienced something like that in Pendle Hill, where everyone walked out and we knew we had experienced it. And I actually, this was, I think, about 10 years ago, and yet I just got an email from a friend that I met there that I hadn't heard from in years that again mentioned that how powerful that was.
That's right. That's right. Well, thank you for talking about that. And we can't leave this conversation without talking about the power of the dog. And that would be Rufus in the story. And I think Rufus, the dog, another character, epitomizes unconditional love in this story. But tell us about this kind of perfect but imperfect dog, too, as we wind things up here.
Okay. Well, I will say this, that that's another autobiographical element, which is the dog is based on the dog that I had that was pretty much exactly like Rufus.
Mm-hmm.
And so this dog is very much a dog. He has atavistic urges. He's not a perfect dog by any means, and he does all the gross dog things that dogs do. But he innately understands what people need. And he is always there when they need them and the way they need him to be there for him. And my dog that I had Rufus is based on, was very much like that. Someone could be sad on a different floor and he would immediately know and run to them and lay his head in their lap.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. So Rufus is physically present for everyone, and he's also seems to be spiritually present in a lot of ways. And so for all you dog lovers out there who rely on this kind of a connection with another being, this book, you will find a lot to enjoy in this book and the character of Rufus. So are you going to keep writing, do you think, Joanne? What is your future now that I know you're just launching this book, but are you going to continue?
Oh, yes, yeah. No, I'm working on another novel.
Mm-hmm.
So I am very much going to keep. You learn so much when you write a novel that it would be a pity not to use that knowledge again.
Okay, well, that's good news. So we've been listening and talking to Joanne Tompkins and talking about her book, What Comes After, set here in Port Townsend, but, with a lot of elements that are from Port Townsend, but a lot of elements for everyone to enjoy, no matter where they live. Please join me next time to talk more about books and authors. I'm your host, Chris Wilson. You can listen to past shows and other programs from the podcast page on the website at kptz.org. And you can make a donation to the station there as well. Thank you for all of the volunteers and supporters who make this station possible. Thanks again. We'll talk to you next time.
You must have been in a place so dark you couldn't feel the light, reaching for you through that stormy cloud. Now here we are gathered in our little hometown. This can't be the way you meant to draw a crowd. Oh, that's what I keep asking. Was there anything I could have said or done? Oh, I had no clue you were masking a troubled soul. God only knows what went went wrong, and why you leave the stage in the middle of a song.